So hello, welcome to another Bereavement UK podcast. I'm very blessed today to having a very dear friend, Linda. I met Linda when I was working at the hospice, and Linda's very, very kindly offered to come in and to talk about and share with you her story. Now, Linda is very inspirational, an amazing person, and I do hope that you will enjoy our chat this afternoon. So, hi, Linda.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for inviting me over here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you to come and see us, because I always feel uplifted when I've been around you, Linda. So I thought what we'd do is I'd just start off by saying, let's get back to when you were very small, because yours is a really interesting story. And there is a reason for telling your story, which we can get to at the end, because we've got to start at the beginning. So thinking about when you were little and what kind of steered you towards the work that you've done, and you've done some pretty amazing work.
Well, I suppose it all began when I was born. My father was still away in the RAF, having been flying in the war, so he wasn't around and I didn't bond with him. My mother, I later learned, had postnatal depression, so I couldn't bond with her, but I was looked after by her mother, my gran, and her sister, Jane. And I suppose it's only latterly that I realised that I actually did bond very, very closely with them. And they played a big part, really, in my upbringing. My gran clearly has died now. My aunt is still there, but very much a part of my life. So it wasn't until, I guess, later on that I realised the significance of bonding and how it meant that certain people became important in your life, but they weren't necessarily your birth mother and father, as you might have expected.
I can connect to that, yeah. So you were brought up by your aunt and your grandmother?
Initially, yes. My childhood was very mixed, really. I suppose because I hadn't bonded so well with my mother and father, they found it quite difficult. To them, I was a naughty girl, so I took on this persona and became the naughty girl and did all the things that one shouldn't do.
Like what?
Well, like smoking in the toilets, and how can you possibly behave like this? What would your father think of you? You know, that was always held over me, really. So I became, it was a bit like a challenge,
imagine you
really.
Smoking in the toilet. Oh, that's quite funny.
Never mind what went on behind the bike sheds. So I was always a disappointment, really, to my parents. And it wasn't until some time later that I actually realised it wasn't me that was the naughty child so much as their expectation of me that was not what they wanted of me. And it was probably at that point that I first developed a kind of inner strength, because I had to survive. I started off life as a teacher because that's what my father did, and I didn't get to university, so what else was there at that time?
What did you teach? Everything?
I taught juniors, yes, I taught everything. And I did quite enjoy it, and I obviously did very well, according to marks and things that I got, but I sort of fell out of favour with it. And it was at that time that my mother actually died of breast cancer. And that may have contributed towards my feelings, but I knew I had to get out of teaching. Really, all I was doing was following a pattern that had been set for me. And it wasn't actually the way I wanted to go. However, it gave me a lot of experience with children, a lot of experience with parents, which were very valuable experiences. So some say I went out of the frying pan into the fire because I went into social services and worked as a social work assistant, which is another name for an unqualified social worker. And I loved it. I worked with, generically actually, but my greatest love was with older people. And in those days, you could go and have a cup of tea with one of your clients, just turn up, have a lovely afternoon and chat. Obviously, things changed and got harder. I'm trying to think now, I can't remember how many years ago, but people kept nagging me to go and get trained, and I always came up with excuses until my boys left home, and I thought, well, I will have to go and get trained as a social worker. I've got no more excuses. So I threw myself into that. It was jolly hard. I hadn't done any academic work for years. And right in the middle of my course, the cancer came back.
Had you had the cancer before you had the boys then?
Yes, I'd had, initially, I'd had a lump the size of a pea above my right breast area. And everybody said, oh, it's nothing, but we'll just check it out. And it turned out to be malignant, so I had a lumpectomy. And I had radiotherapy, but I mean, I'm going back 35 years, so it was quite different in those days. And then I was fine until I went to university and it cropped up again. And this time it was, oh, you've got to have a mastectomy. So right in the middle of my course, I had a mastectomy.
And how old were the boys then? How old were your boys then?
The boys were, they would be in their 20s because they'd gone off to university. It was just Peter and I at home.
So were you studying at the same time as your boys then at university? Yes. Oh, wow. Wow.
Yes, it was it was quite exciting, really. And thankfully, I had the mastectomy in the holiday, so it didn't really interfere. But it was, I suppose that was the start for me of my, of living with this cancer. It affected my arm in that I developed lymphedema, which had its own complications. For me, that was very often worse than actually having the cancer. And I still have lymphedema, but thankfully it doesn't become the problem that it used to. So there I was, having become newly qualified, thrown back at work.
Having just had this mastectomy.
Having just had a mastectomy.
Wow.
And I kind of carried on. I had to become very strong at that point. For me, there was no option. There was no backing out or saying, I can't do this, I'm poorly. I'd done all this work. I wasn't going to let it. So I needed to carry on, and I did, as a social worker.
So where were you working as a social worker?
I was actually working in the community, in Hemel, and then.
What was that, mainly with the elderly?
Yes.
Still.
Yeah. Yes, mainly with the elderly, and then social services changes itself every year or so it changed again, and I had the opportunity to join a mental health team working with older people, which was a real insight. Not only was I now working for the NHS with all its different philosophies and ideas, but I was working in an environment which was quite new to me, although I had developed an interest in older people's mental illness, particularly in things like dementia. And so I found myself dealing a lot of the time with people with dementia.
And had the mastectomy now, had the cancer gone on the back burner then? That's it?
Yes, yes. As far as I knew, that was done and dusted. And I put it out of my mind. I then came up to retirement age. And for many years, I had been working at St. Francis Hospice as a volunteer in the bereavement section. And working on the telephone with people. And I really felt that I had empathy and skill and understanding, and I could make connections with these people. I really felt that I was doing something worthwhile. But when I decided to retire, I thought that maybe I could do a bit more at the hospice. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to form a new group for carers. And I would be the carers' support coordinator. And I would have a team of volunteers. I'd never had a team of volunteers in my life, so that was a whole new area. I'd never set up a group. Mm. I'd never had this kind of responsibility before, but I knew I could do it because it was the work that I'd been doing, assessment work, and understanding people and getting alongside them and their carers. So I knew I could do it as well as anybody could. So I threw myself into this work, had a wonderful team of volunteers, who many of whom I still see, learnt an awful lot about how to work with volunteers, and really got into this and really enjoyed it. And then I was hit again. This time, dreadful pains in my ribs. And after 18 months of agony, really, I was diagnosed with secondary cancer. That was a tremendous shock to me. I suppose naively, I hadn't thought it would ever come back. And I remember vividly waiting for this phone call from the doctor who was going to give me this news, whatever it would be, and Alex sitting with me and holding my hand, and the shock of hearing that, yes, the cancer had come back, and no, there were no operations available. That was a tremendous shock to me. And I knew at that point I had two options. I either gave in and sat in the corner and cried and thought, that's it, I'm dying. Or I took hold of myself and said, okay, I am dying. I'm in a situation where I don't want to be, but I've no choice. This is where I am. And I am going to do my damnedest to do all the things I want to do and to be the sort of person I want to be. And I don't know whether it was the hospice situation, my colleagues around me, the volunteers that I had in my group, I guess it was all of them really, that gave me that tremendous strength and support to carry on.
Do you think you have to want to? I've heard this so many times. You've got to want to get through it, haven't you? And really focus on that. And I mean, I've seen your journey, and I've seen how it's been just chunk by chunk, really.
Yes, I mean,
you do some pretty amazing things, don't you? You sing, you do yoga. You do more than I do, really, Linda.
Well, there are some things that assist with this inner strength. I can't explain this inner strength or this energy. I only know it's there, and I only know it's very powerful. And I have a duty, really, to go with it. It's not for me to dismiss it, because it's there and I must use it. And yoga has always been very important in my life, and it still is. And amazingly, I can still do a lot of things at yoga that I can't do on my own at home. And I don't know why that is, but that's how it is. I discovered when I left the hospice, eventually I knew with the treatment I was having, the chemo and the radiotherapy, that I couldn't carry on with my job at the hospice. I hadn't got the energy, and so I left. I can't remember what I was going to say next.
You were saying that you were thinking about what you were going to do.
Yes.
In the future. And
I had always had in my mind that I would like to sing, and a community choir had just been formed, and I couldn't do it while I was working at the hospice, because it was on the day that I was working. So when I left, I thought, right, I will join it. And I went to the young lad who directs our choir, and I said, I can't sing, but I want to sing. And he looked at me and he said, Linda, that's absolutely fine. I will help you find your voice. And he has, quite amazingly. And I now have singing lessons once a week as well from somebody.
Presumably that helps with the breathing, does it? Does that help you?
Yes. Mm. It gets more difficult now for me to sing, as my breathing is more difficult. But it does make me focus on where I'm breathing, and you know, the parts of your body that you use when you breathe, and it makes me think more about that. And okay, sometimes I don't get to the end of a line, but that doesn't matter, that's not important. The important thing is that I have tried to do it. And I get so much pleasure from singing. All this about it releasing endorphins and everything, it's all true, it's totally true. When I've been singing, I am quite high, actually. It does wonders for me.
I think what I've noticed is that, when I'm thinking, you know, if anybody listens to this eventually and they are terminally ill, I think I'm using this as a phrase, it's so easy to disengage with life and to feel like, well, the end is nigh, so I'm disengaging. A lot of people do that, but you engaged with life. I mean, I remember the first year when you didn't expect, I mean, this is now 4 years on, we were saying over our cup of tea earlier, and we didn't expect that you would be here in 4 years. We thought it was going to be
much
a lot
shorter.
But I remember you ringing me and saying, I'm going bodyboarding next week. And you've just told me you're going to do that again with your lovely grandchildren. And so where does someone get that from? Where do you know, in the face of adversity when everything seems so bleak, how do you get this strength? What drives
you? I can't explain it. I can't explain the energy that's working inside me. I don't know what it is. It's not tangible. I just know that it's there and it drives me. I don't know whether I'll achieve the bodyboarding next week, but hey, I'll give it a damn good try.
Mm.
And I will, I do still try the things that I really want to do. I mean, one time I did long distance walking, walked 10 or 15 long distance paths. Now I can do maybe half a mile. But that's okay. I can do that. Never mind about what's gone.
It's what is.
Yes.
Mm.
I've had those wonderful experiences in the past, but they belong to the past. What's important now is what I can do now.
Mm.
And sometimes I have got the energy, in which case I get on and do it. If I haven't got the energy, I know my body is telling me, okay, you need to rest a bit now, and it'll change later.
And you were talking to me earlier on about, you know, the boys and the future. You seem to have, because we check in every so often, don't we, and have a chat. And there was a time of huge grieving with you of what you might not have. And now things seem a bit more settled, you know, in your personal life. So you've kind of been around for that as you had wanted to be. And now you said to me the other day, I'm not afraid of dying now. I'm not afraid of any of that now. It's more or less like you're on this journey. And
I think I have been extremely lucky. It doesn't feel like it's me that's doing this. Something inside me or some external force that I can't explain is supporting me and holding me and getting me through this. And I realised maybe a couple of years ago that I didn't like uncertainty, although having cancer is uncertain. Mm. You can't predict the end. I certainly can't predict the end. It is uncertain. But there were things that I could actually sort. And so I have. I've made preparation for my death as far as I can. I didn't find it hard to do, and I didn't find it emotional, strangely.
Because I think you're living with it now, aren't you? You've kind of moved through. That's what I was saying. As you seem to me now to be adjusted in a way to that.
I do feel sorted.
Mm.
I've sorted my funeral. I've written my letters to the children and to Peter.
Are they of advice for the future and things? And did you do Peter like a cookbook or something
no,
like that?
I didn't.
No. Or remind him what day's the bingo. I'm just, yeah, things like that.
The one thing I did say straight away to Peter was, isn't it fantastic we're still together?
Mm.
Because after nearly 45 years of marriage, I can't say it's been the easiest. It's been a very rocky road, and there were times when either of us would have gone our separate ways, but we are still together. And although neither of us likes the situation we're in, we are dealing with it together.
Mm.
Which I think is quite amazing. So my letter begins with a congratulations, didn't we do well, we got this far together.
Mm. But it doesn't feel like 45 years, though, does it?
No.
It goes so quickly, doesn't
no.
it? Time just goes quickly.
It has gone so quickly.
Mm.
But I feel a sense of peace in that I have sorted what I can sort, ready for my death. And although I can't take away the grieving and the sadness and whatever my family and friends will experience, they have to go through that. I can't help them through that. I thought I could, but I realise now I can't. They've got to do that bit themselves. But I'd like to think that maybe the things I've said in my letters will act as a bit of support and encouragement. And just really to tell them that it's not always going to be like this.
Mm.
You know, the grief and the sadness won't be as intense forever. And at the same time, to give my grandchildren situations that they can remember me by and maybe smile. I would like to think that my grandchildren would remember me.
What comes to mind then is when you went to stay and the blow-up bed collapsed. Remember telling me about that?
all sorts of funny situations. Yes, Peter and I were lying on this blow-up bed and Thomas, bless him, my eldest grandson, had been up in the bedroom the day before and got very angry about something he'd been told he couldn't do. And I think, possibly in his anger, maybe he didn't really know what he was doing, but he pierced the blow-up bed with a pair of scissors. And halfway through that night, Peter and I realised that part of us was on the floor.
You got that sinking feeling.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, yeah, there have been lots of times when we've, you know, laughed together. And I'd like them to be able to remember things like that and just have a little giggle, even if it's inside. Think, oh, yeah, that was funny with Grandma.
Well, Linda, you are a ray of sunshine. And I haven't known you that long, as you say. We met at the hospice, but I've witnessed a lot of this journey, and to me, inspirational. You always come up with something very balanced, even when things are seeming really out of kilter. And you know, you've always been at the end of the phone and to chat to, and really, you know, you're such a brick.
Alex, that's so kind of you to say that. I suppose I would say what the energy that drives me is such a positive force. I don't have room for negativity in my life. I have to look at everything in a positive way.
And reflecting on your life, it feels to me like you're quite content with where that journey, starting with not having the ideal, what they say, the mum and the dad, or the parenting in that sense, but your journey has been one of maybe coming from that, of that beginning. Understanding people, perhaps it gave you that great understanding which you have of other people and their situations and that empathy.
I do feel that I can understand people and I can empathise.
Mm.
And I'm thankful to have that skill because it's been great to use it. Absolutely great to use it. But I guess I have to go back to the idea that no matter how awful life is, you have to find a positive. And that's what I've always tried to do. Whatever has been happening to me, whether it be losing my hair whilst having my chemo and having to wear all these different wigs, I just had fun with it. It wasn't ever going to be anything that would get me down. And me and my friends would giggle for ages about my wigs and how they would keep slipping and falling off. And that was fine. That was absolutely fine. And they were the things that got me through the hard times, really. And this seems a very strange thing to say, but I actually feel at this moment more content with my life than any other time.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to say. Linda, on behalf of all of the people that you've helped, I think thank you for giving us this really lovely interview, which is an absolute treasure. You're amazing.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you. Mm. Big kiss down the mic there. And yeah, I hope you've enjoyed listening to Linda, and we'll see you again next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I'm okay, but he might want...